Consequence Podcast Network.
This week on The Sidetrack, we'll be joined by film director Kevin Phillips and screenwriter Ben Collins, two of three individuals responsible for the genre classic Super Dark Times. They'll be here to talk about that, indie film, their craft, and a film that they hold in high regard, PTA's 2012 masterpiece, The Master. That's this week on The Sidetrack. Welcome back to yet another edition of The Sidetrack. It's me, your host, Paul Davidson. Thanks for joining us this week. This, if you're listening to this in a timely fashion, this is coming out mere days, mere hours before Thanksgiving, before a historic Thanksgiving in which we will all sit alone in our homes without getting to see our families. Well, maybe on Zoom, there'll be a lot of computers sitting at certain places around the table so that we can all virtually see our family and friends. On that positive note, on that inspiring holiday familial note, I have so much news. I have so many things to share this week. At the top of that list is the great news that starting this week, on this episode, The Sidetrack will be a part of the Consequence Podcast Network. That is the podcast network as created by none other than consequenceofsound.net, a penultimate site for all your news, reviews, and features around film, television, and music. But we have been fans of the site for a long time. I'm a fan of these guys. They have a great selection of podcasts already, some that you may have already heard of, podcasts from Assembly to The Opus to This Must Be the Gig, The Losers Club. You can find it all on consequenceofsound.net. Now, what does that mean for you? Because it's all about you, right? Nothing changes. You can continue to get the show the way you have received the show already to date. It just means that here or there, you may hear a short, painless advertisement. That's about it. And we appreciate the passion from the Consequence team for the podcast, our podcast. You'll see a lot more promotion around the show. And the goal here is to join forces and just continue to grow the audience for what we're doing here. Because we are loving doing it, and we just want more and more people to join us in that endeavor. The one other thing that comes with this evolution for the podcast is that you, as a listener, as a passionate listener, also have the opportunity to help us continue to grow. And what does that entail? That means you can throw us some scratch on a monthly basis. If you look at the description in any of our most recent episodes, you'll find a link to our anchor.fm page where you can support the podcast on a monthly basis. You can choose to throw us 99 cents or more. And anything that you do, you know, support or throw our way will help us to continue to deliver episodes on a week-to-week basis. That's what that's for. So we'll say it once, we'll throw it out there, and we'll leave it to you. Now let's move on with this week's episode. In 2017, when I was running The Orchard, there was a small genre thriller, genre horror film called Super Dark Times that came across my desk. Some of the acquisitions folks that were working for me saw it at a film festival, not even a major film festival. And when I saw the film for the first time, I was blown away with the quality, with the feel, the vibe of the film. It had vibes of, and I don't want to minimize the uniqueness of the film, but it had a like an 80s Stranger Things vibe to it, but much deeper. And the character work and the camera work was stunning. One of the reasons why I think the camera work was so stunning was Kevin Phillips, the director. This was his directorial debut. Prior to this film, he spent most of his time doing camera work as a DP. So it makes total sense that when you watch this film, you immediately see the craft from behind the lens. But the film itself, the screenplay, as co-written by Ben Collins and his partner in writing Super Dark Times, Luke Piotrowski, is also high watermark here from a perspective of craft. It's a film that people stumble upon. It's on Netflix. You can see it, I think, on a worldwide basis on Netflix today. It's a film people stumble upon and end up writing these passionate paragraphs and tweets about because they don't know why they've never heard of it before. Well, we're going to talk a bit about that, how that film came to be, some of the other things that these guys have been working on. And then, of course, why have they chosen PTA's 2012 film, The Master, for their feature-length audio commentary, which will be available as a separate episode now that we're splitting atoms here at the Sidetrack. So let's get on with it. Let's head on over to the interview ring and spend some time with director Kevin Phillips and screenwriter Ben Collins here on the Sidetrack. So as promised, here we are virtually sitting with director Kevin Phillips and screenwriter, writer extraordinaire, Ben Collins. Guys, welcome. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Paul. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. I was saying to these guys ahead of time as we were prepping for the show, and I'll wax on poetic about it later, the commentary these guys did is super, super entertaining. So we'll get to it, but there's lots of good stuff to hit this week. Now, I let in on this a little bit at the beginning of this episode. My history with the creative output of both of you and then your third partner in crime on Super Dark Times, Luke, goes back to 2017. But before I touch on Super Dark Times, the thing that I think is so fascinating is there's this between, you know, Kevin, Ben, Luke, some of the producers on Super Dark Times, you've all seemingly known each other for like multiple decades. What was the history there?
Well, so Luke and I went to high school together in Fayetteville, Georgia, which is like a south of Atlanta. Right. I guess it's a city and it's a small town, like a suburban town that we both went to high school there. And then I went to college at the Savannah College of Art and Design. And that's where I met Kevin.
Got it.
Then Kevin, you can pick up the other parts.
But Savannah was before Emerson, or did you not go to Emerson?
Oh, no, that we did not. We are not Emerson guys.
What's the Emerson connection? Is there none?
We have friends that went there. They're sort of around all the time, and I didn't really know what that was. Because I only ever applied to Savannah College of Art and Design because I just had such low expectations for what was going to happen in my life. I wanted to go to like NYU or something. And so I didn't even know what the good schools were. I just lived in Georgia, and that was the art school that made sense to go to. I don't know how you ended up there, Kevin, but
there's a lot of transplants from Emerson in the Los Angeles scene. I know, as far as filmmaking goes, a lot of our colleagues and friends that we met once we moved out to LA are Emerson kids.
Got it. Okay.
But no, for me as well, it was an NYU thing, right? I only applied to New York. And to Savannah, Georgia, on behest of my parents. They recommended the college. And then I went there as like a trial run during my junior and senior year of high school to take some courses, and I loved it. And then once I actually got to the college, I met Ben my second year in, I think, or was it my first year, Ben? I think it was, yeah.
It was my first year, your second year, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And we hit it off immediately. And then from there, you know, the thing that college granted us was the chance to meet, you know, incredibly talented people that would go on to become not only our friends, but our collaborators who we work with to this day. And as well on so many of them on the film Super Dark Times.
I mean, what is it about Savannah? There's a lot of people who will apply to colleges, SC, UCLA, NYU. Like, there's some element of it that's tied to just networking and names, and you can throw it out, and it's a calling card. But what's the practical, with the practical experience that comes out of someplace like Savannah that you say Savannah was great for X?
I think I wonder if at any given time, this is just a speculation, but if at any given time, there's like maybe some school somewhere that wants to be bigger than it is, right, and is kind of like trying to do, you know, to do that from a sort of outsider perspective. And I think at the time, and I say at the time because I don't know what the culture is like there now, But at the time, Savannah was like trying to, Savannah College of Art and Design was trying to compete with the bigger schools. And so they were buying a lot of equipment and they were letting us use it in a less regulated way than what I hear like some of the larger film schools were at. And like, for instance, we like every student got to make a senior project as opposed to like at the bigger schools, which I didn't even know until years later that like you have to like pitch against your students and only certain ones get picked and, you know, that sort of thing. So I think like at the time anyways, we were kind of like outside any perspective on what the industry was like. And we had a bunch of gear that, you know, we otherwise wouldn't have had. And we, like Kevin said, we met, you know, you find the people that you want to, you know, work with. And there was a kind of freedom to it, I think, at the time. And I don't know if it's like that now, but I imagine somewhere there's a school that is like that. I think that's the main benefit, you know.
Have either of you guys been asked back to the school?
Not really. I think they're a little bit more conservative, I think, than people think art schools are.
Yeah.
And I, as soon as we started making this movie, Super Dark Times, I was kind of like, yeah, that might not really be, you know, I think they would have been more happy if we'd made like Beasts of the Southern Wild or something, maybe, right. If I had to say. I mean, who wouldn't be, honestly, you know, like, but I think that that's, I think that maybe our style, while, you know, eventually I'm sure they'll take credit for us or something at some point. I don't know that it was that interesting to them, honestly.
Yeah, the one thing I can really attribute, I think, to your earlier question, Paul, about like the people that we've met there and the kind of environment that it fostered. I think what I'd say is that it was, you know, exceptionally an art school in the sense that we were really allowed to focus on many different mediums. And I think even though most of the collaborators that we work with to this day, you know, studied film at that college, you know, I think it just offered us a really diverse background. And all of these friends that we work with, you know, they all kind of just had a more dimensional experience in college where it wasn't just film focused, you know?
Right.
And I think that really kind of attributed to, I don't know, just like the diverse and varied friendships that we have. And in a way, I think that must have caused a greater, you know, understanding and appreciation for the filmmaking medium and for one another.
I agree with that.
And what was it when you guys met for the first time? What is that thing that you guys connect, like what connected the two of you? What was that crossover?
This is what I remember, Paul. So I would see Ben Collins kind of moseying around the campus, which is like this big sprawling campus in Savannah. It's really kind of branched out all over the city. And I'd see this guy and he'd have this like Woody Allen jacket on.
What is
Candy
a Woody
Hall,
Allen
right,
jacket?
Ben? It's from
like a corduroy. No, it's from Interiors. It's a corduroy sport coat that actually was a piece of wardrobe from the movie Interiors that Sam Waterston wears in like one scene, I think.
Okay.
And a teacher I had in high school gave it to me because I had a similar coat that I'd found at the thrift store. And she was like, oh, you might like this. So this was like my prized possession. I was like, well, you know, I looked like a Wes Anderson character or something.
You really did. I saw this kid walking around and he had these giant headphones on and he never seemed to talk to anybody. And he would just always be like listening to something. And it wasn't until one day in the cafeteria at the dorm, I was with my roommate at the time. And I'm like, who's this guy over here? Do you know this kid? And he's sitting all alone, Ben Collins, over the table. And I'm like, I'm going to go up and introduce myself to him. And this is something I rarely do. And I really am like, I'm quite
oh, in retrospect, it's like incredibly rare.
Yeah, I don't do this. But I went up and started talking to Ben. And he was extremely kind and you know, cordial and welcoming. And we kind of just hit it off immediately. And he was listening to the band Love. And I think, you know, we kind of just like from the onset, we found more in, you know, familiarity and similarity than not. And then I think from there, we just started hanging out and just talking about movies and watching movies and talking about music and listening to music. And soon thereafter, I think, you know, we just kind of started working together as much as possible.
Well, and so you flash forward, and I'm being partially facetious, you know, 40 years later, I think it was more like 15 or something, but you guys, you know, people start to, you know, find their way to Los Angeles. Luke is the last one, I think, to move there. Ben, you're in LA. Kevin, you're you're directing or you're cinematography, you know, DP on music videos, you're directing music videos and commercials. And amidst this whole thing, the idea of Super Dark Times comes out between Luke and Ben. Kevin digs it. And then the three of you for at least, what, 3 or 4 years are really just developing that script together, kind of handing it off one to the other until you get to a point where it's something that everybody feels excited about. Your producing friends from school are able to help raise the money. I mean, that's kind of like the progression, yeah?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was right away when we had the idea that you know, the three of us believed could be a movie, we got Jet Steiger involved because he was another, like you said, another guy we went to school with that he'd been producing, you know, some independent films at that point. And it was just a kind of a no-brainer to go straight to him because we knew it was an odd idea that wasn't going to be like the big spec sale of that year or whatever. So right. It made sense to think of it that way. And we went on that way for a few years until we added producer Richard Pete, who also went to school with us. But I didn't really know him in school. Kevin knew him more from jobs and stuff after school. So with that team, that was sort of the group that got the money and then, you know, off to the races, I guess. But yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. And so for me, flashing forward then, so 2017 hits and the film premieres at Rotterdam. Is that right? That's the first place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'll never forget. I get a call from one of my acquisitions folks who's there at Rotterdam, sees the film.
Wow.
And is like, you got to get a link. You got to see this film. And what's, I even just watched it again recently, just in preparation of sitting down with you guys. And I have clearly a soft spot, you know, in my heart for this movie because it's something that I, you know, we acquired and we distributed and we worked with you guys on. But it fights well above its weight to a certain extent. I don't know if you guys are comfortable even sharing what the movie costs, but the movie looks, I mean, it looks absolutely amazing. When that you press play on this movie, and I've let everybody know, it's on Netflix. You can stream it now globally. I mean, you see there's the level of quality and sheen and composition of how the film opens and just the visuals of the film. And again, you know, a testament to Kevin and, you know, his eye through the camera lens. It really feels like a much bigger movie than it probably cost.
Yeah, I mean, I think the easy thing to say, I don't think it's out of line, especially this many years out, to say, you know, under a million is probably the, you know, the safe number to put it. And I do think that, you know, while we always could have used more money and more time, I mean, I don't think there's any movie where that isn't the case. But I do think it was, we sort of knew going in not to present ourselves with narrative things that were too difficult to capture. And we knew as writers, you know, Kevin's style. And so we were able to write scenes and craft around either things that we imagined would look great when Kevin shot them, or as the script developed, things that Kevin would tell us, you know, this is the way I want to do this. And that would inspire, you know, adjustments to, you know, the way scenes were staged or described or things like that. And I think some of that, I mean, it's funny because like the student films that Kevin and I did were at the time, you know, we were like doing a lot of VFX stuff. You know, it was like that was the chance, you know, in film school world, that's like a big thing to like cross coordinate with different departments and actually hire VFX people,
sure,
you know, hire quote unquote, no one's getting paid. But like, so we were doing stuff at the time that was like really, really, really reaching for the highest production value you could possibly get. But I think through that, we also learned some of the limitations and some of the results. Mm-hmm. You're like, yeah, well, that worked technically, but it doesn't look as good as it could. So I think we were wary of like things that we knew were impossible to do and wanted to sort of cater the whole thing to succeed in the way that you're describing as much as possible. So I do really appreciate when people see that in it. I don't know if I talked too much there, Kevin, or if you've got other thoughts.
No, but... I think, no, naturally you summed it up very well. you know, Paul, I think one interesting thing I'd say about this is that, you know, we went into making this movie the best we could, but we had no, you know, presumptions about the idea that anybody would see this movie. You know, we thought, I remember sitting down with Ben, you know, maybe months before we actually went into production at a little, like we were just having a coffee or something. And I was naturally nervous about the chance of making this thing, right? And Ben was just like, look, no one's gonna see this weird little fucking movie, right? Like, no, it's like there's nothing, it's like, you know, it's like, we, and in a way that kind of like liberated us in a sense, because it kind of, we still wanted to make like the best possible thing that we could, right? And we still wanted to focus on like quality, like the quality that was intrinsic to the screenplay and the craft that we wanted to kind of display that with on film. We're all coming at this from a place of just like loving cinema and really wanting to make something that we could then and others could truly appreciate. And so it was a weird kind of conflation of this like fearlessness, and this idea that, well, if anybody does ever see this movie, let's really try to kind of like, just, you know, hit them hard with it. So I think that was kind of like, that was like a dominant thought for me personally going into the movie. Let's make the best possible thing we can, and really just focus on quality. And I think ultimately what that did for us with our very modest budget was just, you know, kind of navigate it and allow us to have the time we needed to really craft the story the way that we needed to.
I think something, and I haven't thought about this before, but your question made me think about it, Paul. I think like that I had the luck of my dad got satellite TV when I was in high school. So I, as a teenager, watched a lot of like Independent Film Channel and like Sundance Channel stuff.
Right.
So I think that I had the context in a way for independent films that don't become breakout hits, because, you know, at the time, I mean, I'm trying to think like Clerks or something would have been the paradigm for like, you know, the big hit, you know, breakout indie thing. Oh, you make it for so, or like Robert Rodriguez, like El Mariachi, you know, like that type of thing.
Slacker.
And yeah. And it's like, so you know that that is possible, but when you watch Sundance Channel or Independent Film Channel enough, you'll see a movie that you've never heard of that is like totally amazing. And you go look it up and it's not even like, you know, on DVD, and like no one's ever heard of it. And it's like, yeah, oh yeah, that premiered at, you know, the festival at Sundance in 1994, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I still liked those movies. So in my mind, it was like, okay to be one of those movies, because I knew how much it meant to me as like a 15-year-old seeing something truly inspiring that wasn't a big deal in the way that success is typically measured in this industry. So I think that like it's different now, even just with streaming and everything like that. But at the time when we started making Super Dark Times, it was like okay to me for it to be, you know, the favorite movie of 1 out of 10 people, not the movie that, you know, people like just enough, you know, 7 out of 10 of them or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's okay to do that if you're being true to yourself. And like Kevin's saying, like going in with the right intentions, like we just wanted to make a good movie. It wasn't about, you know, being the next Little Miss Sunshine or something. Right. I think it's a weird set of priorities for somebody to have ahead of the quality in the, you know, in the first place. But yeah, we certainly had no illusions that it was going to sell for, you know, $20 million at, you know, whatever or something, but yeah.
Well, and it's, you know, it's funny, like people, you talk about people, you're creating a film, you're writing it, you're directing it. Eventually you have your chance at, just like you do as a writer, Ben, your first draft is your draft. Eventually other people's opinions will impact what that looks like. Same thing sometimes as a director. I mean, depending on if you know, hold on to director's cut or not. But once you release that film into the world, I mean, now that film's been out 3 years and has the benefit of not only, you know, a small theatrical, but also a significant, you know, exposure on Netflix on a global basis, then it becomes the public, it becomes theirs, and they kind of, you know, view it in the way that they do. I mean, it's interesting, you look at on the heels of that movie coming out, people talked about it, you know, it was Stand By Me, it was meets Donnie Darko, but it's been fascinating to see that. And I guess the question for you guys is, did you feel once that movie came out, was there a bit of like an acceleration in the day-to-day opportunities for you? I know at the time, Kevin, I think you had already been doing tons of music videos. I have to believe, Ben, you have so many things in development. You probably had other things going at the same time. But was there kind of an awareness of it and a ability for it to accelerate what was going on for you guys?
It took a delay, yes. And Kevin, you may have a different experience, but to me, I like, because at the time, like when we were filming the movie, Luke and I were writing on several like assignments, like, you know, during production. Like I was on set and Luke was back. He was still living in Atlanta at the time. And so we were talking every day about both what we were shooting and making adjustments to that, but also what we were developing. And I was, you know, I mean, there's a movie, one of the movies we have in prep right now was actually like, we wrote the pitch while I was on set. Like I literally remember stepping away from the monitor to go call him to figure out the ending of the pitch. And like, you know, now it's a thing. So like, it stuff was happening and I sort of assumed like, oh yeah, you know, like that'll be a big, you know, bump for us when everybody, you know, hears that we have a movie coming out. But it took about a year, I want to say, like for just enough people within the more mainstream Hollywood, you know, to see the movie or be aware of it enough to kind of recalibrate their expectation about what they thought Luke and I, you know, were good at based on that. And so it was like, yeah, as soon as people saw it, we got a lot of people asking us to write movies that had teenagers in it and stuff like that, because it was like, oh, that displays a different kind of character thing. And so instead of being just like the horror movie guys, it would be like, hey, we've got this horror script, but the characters aren't good. Can you help us write, you know, like fix that kind of thing? Or that was sort of the motivation. And that was really nice, because when you do something that you're proud of and people see the things that you're proud of as being, you know, worthwhile enough that they want you to do those type of things for them, it does feel good. But it was not immediate. It was like maybe a year after the movie like was released, I think, even before I started to feel like that was part of the conversation. I don't know, Kevin, was it similar for you or different?
Well, you know, I'll always get a kick out of anybody telling me that they seen this movie and they like it. You know, it'll always be extremely rewarding. And in that regard, I'll say that, you know, since the movie did come out, those that have seen the film, that work in development, that work in studios, that wanted to take meetings, you know, I would get naturally a lot of project ideas coming at me that were more genre based. Some are much more interesting than others, par for the course. But the most rewarding aspect of all of that, I think, is that this movie, the script that Ben and Luke wrote, you know, that this movie kind of was this great blend of genre, and it allowed us to do so many different things with story, with the medium, right? And in a way, it became hard for me as a filmmaker to even kind of classify in terms of genre, because it was, again, doing so many different things. And so many of those things that we explored in that story, I loved so much. So it's the people that started kind of, you know, coming at me with having seen Super Dark Times and recognizing just as much that ultimately, you know, I don't know, it's been an extremely, again, to say, rewarding thing that others can notice within it, that this movie isn't necessarily so easily summed up, and that there's aspects within of many different genres, and that, you know, I have a personal desire as a filmmaker to kind of explore many different things, not just one lane of storytelling or filmmaking.
So one of the things that bothers me is that you haven't directed another film. Now, I would you say that you're a perfectionist and or you're afraid of not achieving a certain perfection? Because my impression, and again, I'm personally invested, because after Super Dark Times, I was like, Kevin's got it. Like, where's the next movie? Like, I know you're developing something with Ben and Luke, but what are we waiting for? What is it? I feel like you're gun shy to a certain extent with feature versus the other stuff that you're doing.
Yeah, I can be really precious and very particular, and that kind of, you know, scattershots out to all aspects of my life. Naturally, I know what it takes to make a movie, and that's like a ton of time and an incredible amount of passion. And for me personally, I mean, other filmmakers, they might approach this differently, but what I know it takes from me is just as much. Right. And so I just need to really love it. You know, whatever it's going to be, I need to know that I'm going to love this thing now, and I'm going to love it all the way into the next 2 years, and then so on. Right.
Right.
And so I've just been looking for the right thing. I've just been looking for the right thing to marry myself to. And fortunately, you know, it's taken, yes, it's taken a bit of time, but I think that has been rewarded because I've come across a couple projects now that are extremely intriguing to me. One as much as one that I'm working on with Ben and Luke.
Yeah. What is that, the next one? What's the next feature film? You don't have to call out what it is, but is it the one with Ben, or is there something else that we'll hear about soon that's coming next?
There's a few on the docket that are all in similar stages of development. The one that I'm working on with Ben and Luke, how to say it? It just truly speaks to me at this point in my life, where I am right now in every way. This movie is the greatest extension of myself, as Super Dark Times was when I made it then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to like say too much exciting stuff, you know, because obviously we're about to find out how easy or difficult or, you know, whatever possible or impossible it is to actually make this movie. But yeah, we got very lucky that we found a project that mutually excited all three of us, and it's been a really, really lovely process, which is possible sometimes, apparently, when you have the right people and the right material, that the development process is not incredibly painful as it so often turns out to be. But this has been a good
one. And Ben, as you wake up at 3 a.m. having ideas, aren't you able to just knock on your wall? Because don't you live next door to each other or something?
Yes. We had the good fortune of last year, Kevin needed to move out of his place, and it just timed out perfectly that my next door neighbors moved out, like literally like the same day he told me, or like the next day or something, they moved out. So Kevin moved in next door to me. And that we were already developing this project, but that has absolutely accelerated and improved the process, because 100%, like, we can be texting and then just walk over and talk about stuff, and we do that frequently. or just sitting in the same room, which is not a common thing to do with a director when you're developing. And it actually, like, I'll write in the room with Kevin and like read stuff back to him and stuff to get like immediate feedback, which is an accelerated aspect of the process that we're lucky to have.
Is this Melrose Place? Is it Odd Couple? What's the feel?
Office Space, maybe.
Office Space.
Is it that's the one where he's got the neighbor that he knocks on the wall? I mean, we never actually knock on the wall. You've done it like once, I think, Kevin. You knock on the wall to get my.
You haven't set up a pneumatic tube yet.
Yeah, no, that would be nice.
That would be great. Well, it's so funny because just when you were giving me the background of setting up, doing the commentary with each other, it sounds like you cooked up a meal, some steaks, you have, you know, invite Kevin over. It's like an evening watching the movie.
Yeah, I knew it would be fun for us that way. It's not an unusual night, just the recording.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not an uncommon thing. We'd probably just be watching The Master anyway.
Right.
You know?
So just speaking
totally. We've watched it like 4 times like since quarantine, just like because it's just the best movie to put on. Even if if Kevin's watching it, I'll come over and watch it. Like,
it's funny though, like as scenes are coming up I watch the whole thing, you know it's coming, and it's just funny just watching with you guys. But before I get there, I want to ask a couple of questions. So let me just say, on Super Dark Times, as I said, for folks, if you haven't seen it, you love nostalgia. It's a great story about four friends in high school. Something crazy happens, and it's the aftermath of this very dramatic, very tense situation. I won't give anything away. Although I do want to ask one thing, because I've never gotten the answer to it, and it won't ruin anything in the movie. The opening shot of the movie, the opening sequence, it's kind of a pan in on a broken window in a high school. You come into that room, and there's an animal that's dead in the middle of the room. Is it a what animal is it? I'm forgetting.
It's a deer.
A deer.
Many-pointed deer. Yeah.
So Ben, is that written in the script? Is that was always there as the first image, first moment?
So the original script, the first draft of the script that we had opened with the scrambled porn.
Right.
And so like the idea there, you know, just being like imagining an audience sitting down in the theater, and then the first thing they see is like scrambled porn, which is a great like little nostalgic detail that, you know, will connect with people or make people curious if they don't really understand what it is. And so that was the kind of the goal. And then we added this like yearbook component that is now simultaneous in that scene, and that was the way it was for a while. And then Kevin pitched this deer idea. So I'll let you talk about it, Kevin, but it was one of those things that, like, you know, I mean, he's a friend and he's the director. So there's, you know, it doesn't mean we can't argue if we wanted to, but I think at that point it was such an interesting idea that we just decided to trust it, you know, because it was cool and visual, and it was a great, interesting, evocative way to come into it.
I mean, how do you pitch that, Kevin? Because, you know, I watch that moment, and I, not knowing if I'm watching it for the first time, I say to myself, okay, is this the first beat of multiple beats of something happening in this town? Is this a device to put me off on my heels and make me feel uneasy? Like, when you were pitching that to Ben, when this idea and this visual comes to mind, how are you imagining the way that you're going to use this and the way that you hope it will impact the audience?
Well, I always wanted to make like a quiet movie out of this one.
Yeah.
There was that desire kind of came from a conflation of influences, I think. It's just where we were with our sensibilities at the time, and what was already intrinsic in the script. And to your point, Paul, I think the idea for me was kind of doing many things at once, right? It was at once acting as an omen. It was at once acting as like a tonal keystroke.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, the story as much was derived from like an urban legend that kind of, you know, happened at my school growing up
in
Pennsylvania. This story about this deer that broke into this through this window in the school and then just like bled to death on the ground. And for whatever reason, that when I was reading the script, that kind of just like came to me, because the script naturally was pulling so much from our own individual experiences with youth. And so I think it kind of just, you know, retinkered my brain and just kind of was this just kind of came to me. And I thought like, oh, how interesting, how compelling of an opening this would be, just like a cold open on this kind of, you know, ominous, mercurial kind of scenario, you know. What a way to kind of get an audience just engaged from the onset with also not really knowing what to expect.
Yeah.
Because that's another big thing that kind of plays throughout the whole course of the film you know, leaving the audience always kind of at arm's length, you know, leaving them on their toes.
Yeah.
And I think that was the intention.
It's a haunting way to open it. And I love that moment where the police officer is kneeling and he just kind of like makes this movement of his hand across his neck. Like, that's it. Yeah. It's time to be done. It's great. All right. I had to ask that question.
I love it.
Now, before we talk about The Master, there's a few questions I want to ask you guys, and I categorize these under, I call these like the civilian questions. These are the annoying questions that if you know these from Q&As being at festivals, these are people who have no concept of how the entertainment industry works. Mm-hmm. And so they ask these questions. These fall into the categories of, hey, can I give you my script? Among other things, but like the first question for Ben that I know the answer to, and I know not to ask the question, but somebody who was just a civilian probably would, is, wow, Ben, your movie, The Night House, your EP and writer goes to Sundance in earlier this year. It sells $12 million worldwide deal to Fox Searchlight. Mm-hmm. Are you going to see some of that money? Like, how does that all work? what do you say to that?
I think it's an interesting, yeah, it's been an interesting experience seeing that, because I do think, like, you know, again, growing up watching, you know, the Sundance Channel and the Independent Film Channel, you hear, I would always hear these stories, you know, about like how this stuff worked and would have, you know, my own assumptions and stuff like that. And in this case, I got to learn firsthand what it's like to, you know, experience that. And it's a slow process. So the answer is, yes, I believe so. But I think that people have a misunderstanding of the way the economy of this business works, and people who have large sums of money, they don't just like rush to send those checks out to the people who do the work. You know, it's a you know, it'll get there.
You'll see some upside.
The gears turn slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone else who has no idea the difference between a DP and a director might say to you, Kevin, well, if the DP where the cinematographer is setting up all the scenes and coming to the director with ideas of camera movements and framing, then and the actors are coming, you know, ready to go. What's like, isn't, why wouldn't you say the DP or cinematographer is really directing this film? What is, what's the difference? What's the same?
It's a great question. And I think that distinction kind of varies depending on who you talk to. The cinematographer, their job is basically everything image related. That goes from lighting to lensing to everything under that umbrella, basically. They essentially are in charge of three different departments, the grip, the lighting, and the camera department. And all of this is ultimately in service of the director's vision. And then the director, whoever that may be, decides ultimately how they want to kind of impart that vision visually. And so the cinematographer is in tandem working with the director. A director might be extremely visually astute or not. And in that case, you know, the cinematographer, their work might be cut out for them a little bit differently.
How do you, what, where do you stand on the debate of the, a film by credit?
I think Super Dark Times is a film by Kevin Phillips.
Is it? Does it say that in the credits? I don't remember.
It does. Yeah, it does. Interesting. I think it says it on the poster.
Does it? I don't know. I don't know if it does.
I'm almost positive.
The poster. Remember that? That's a whole. That's a whole episode.
It really is.
I can be very particular. That's a great question. I think it comes down to, again, individual films. And, you know, I am a true believer in the collaborative aspect of filmmaking. On one hand, I feel that there's very, ideally, there's very little room for ego.
Yeah.
On a set and in a medium where you're utilizing the best talents of so many people to kind of get something on its own two feet. And when we made Super Dark Times, for instance, and how I really hope to be moving forward with anything that I do, you know, it's in your best interest as a filmmaker to surround yourself with incredibly talented people that you love and admire. Because ultimately, as a director, no matter how many ideas you may have, and how, you know, crystalline they might be, it doesn't matter, because, you know, you're just ultimately going to get in the way of yourself and in the way of the film if you don't, you know, utilize the many minds that are surrounding the project. Everyone has something to offer, and ultimately, you know, how to say it, I think that you'd be foolish to not be open to the collaboration. That's such a natural part of the process. That's honestly where the magic of filmmaking really comes to pass. I think it's in the collaborative roots.
Your media training has come full circle today. Congratulations. Ben, there was something I saw on Twitter, not on your particular feed, but it was, you know, in film Twitter, screenwriting Twitter, it was a writer kind of putting together a timeline of his day. It was like 9 a.m., get up and write, 9 to 4, you know, write all day, 5 p.m., I'm a genius, 8 p.m., I'm a failure, 3 a.m., I'm a genius, 6 a.m., I'm a failure, 9 a.m., start writing again. Where is your, what does your day look like, and how are you challenging what's the best way to put it? I mean, it's a solitary, unfortunately, you have a writing partner, but screenwriting is a very solitary thing, and it plays with your mind in a pretty significant way. How do you approach that?
Yeah, it's tricky. The approach has varied over the years, and having a partner is fantastic, because while Luke and I don't we don't write in the same room most of the time, almost ever. I mean, we're almost always separate, but we talk on the phone and stuff like that. So, you know, it's like you always have a lifeline if you're feeling stuck. You know, if you have a partner, you can always, you know, if either of us hits a problem, we'll get on the phone and we can usually solve things together. So that's a huge benefit. But in terms of like my own kind of self-motivation, it's changed a lot over the years. And I think like the trick is like, I feel like for me anyways, I kind of have to like let it happen naturally to some degree and find what's working. So like for many, many years, I wrote basically from like maybe like midnight or something until like maybe like 7 a.m.
Oh, wow.
Just because of the where I was living and like the type of job I had at the time, like day job kind of stuff, where like that was just the time of day where I felt the most free. And to some degree, night always has a nice quality because the light doesn't change, is what I figured out eventually. Mm-hmm. Light changing during the day gives you a sense of time passing. And sometimes that's good for your writing, but sometimes you don't want to feel that. You kind of want to feel like you're in a sort of timeless, infinite space where anything is possible. So I think that's really cool. But then, you know, it's like the more, since I became more of like a professional, you know, in that sense, and I don't have a day job outside of this, it's like you have to be available for meetings and, you know, conversations, especially if you're, you know, gearing up to make a movie, you have to get on the phone at the drop of a hat to talk about some, you know, minor change or this or that or whatever. So I can't just work at night. So it's kind of like a floating thing where I have to decide, you know, when I feel best and not force myself or guilt myself too much when I don't feel my best, because I don't think showing up with the wrong attitude is always going to be helpful. You know what I mean? Like if I'm really forcing myself, then I don't know if the work I'm going to get out of it's even going to be worth it. So these days it's kind of like, yeah, I might write for a few hours early and then not do anything all day and then maybe write at night after dinner, or I might go all day just, you know, dealing with other things. And then it's not until the last 3 hours of the day that I get everything done. You know, it fluctuates. I'm not in like a regular groove, especially with the whole pandemic thing. And just like we talked about before, like the stress of all that is just so dissociating. So I wish it was more consistent, but I think the biggest thing is just maximizing the time that you can sit down and do it. You know what I mean? And like taking naps is really good. Like for a long time, I thought that was like a laziness thing, but like, you know, there's a sort of Don Draper magic to it, you know, where sometimes you take a nap and you wake up with a solution to something, or as you're falling asleep, you think of something that you needed to think of. And so not beating yourself up when, you know, again, are you going to sit half asleep at the computer and try desperately to write 2 sentences, or are you going to give yourself that 30 minute nap and maybe you'll be better, you know, at the end of it? So it's like,
the summary in one word with an exclamation point is naps.
Yeah, naps are great.
Naps.
Yeah,
naps are great.
I learned that. I heard that the Coen brothers said that on a podcast like 12 years ago, and I was like, "What?" And it took a long time for it to sink in. But yeah, naps are great.
It does feel very lazy, but you know, people say most of the writing happens when you're not writing, right? It's when you're showering, when you're sleeping, when you're out walking. Like that's when a lot of the ideas 100%. Come.
I mean, the Super Dark Times came to some degree in the shower, actually, because it was a dream I had, and I remembered it in the shower and got out of the shower and was like, shit, maybe that's a movie, you know? Yeah. And that does happen. like, you know, I mean, it sounds like some sort of mythologizing kind of eureka moment thing that people like to pretend, you know, is always the case, but it does happen sometimes that you just have that moment of a lightning strike.
Someday on the SAT, the analogy will be the garage is to Apple's creation as the shower is to the creation of Super Dark Times.
Yeah, you could say that.
Perhaps. All right, let's talk The Master. So
yes.
Talk to me from both your perspectives. Where did you first see the film? How old were you? And then what is it about this film that, you know, inspires you, that caused you to sit down and watch it and do this full length commentary?
So what year did it come out?
Was 2012.
Jesus, was it really? God, that feels like so much more recent. Yeah, so what, 2012, then that means I was like 28, I guess.
Yeah.
When it came out. And so, I mean, it's like, you know, with any time P.T. Anderson has a movie, you know, you hear little murmurs of things. No one ever knows what the fuck the plots are or anything like that. And so it's like, you just knew that this was going to be a thing, you know, that you watch. And then there was some public drama with the development of it. And, you know, we didn't, I think on the recording, we didn't even get into all like the Megan Ellison stuff and everything like that. That's sort of like presumably true. Although now it sounds almost apocryphal. This idea that like, you know, she committed to financing the movie over like a lunch, like her first lunch with Paul or, you know, whatever, P.T. Anderson. And so like that kind of stuff had been sort of floating around. So the anticipation for this movie, I hesitate to say that it was one of the most anticipated movies in the film community at that time, you know, because I think it had been a few years and all the drama of it and the casting rumors and stuff. And so like the anticipation and the excitement for it could not have been higher when seeing it. And I think that had an interesting effect on the response. I can stop talking for now and let Kevin fill in his personal side of it. But yeah, I mean, I can't believe it's been that long. But yeah, that's some of the context.
I mean, the film was something that we were naturally anticipating, you know, not really knowing what to expect, but on the heels of There'll Be Blood, you know, and honestly, everything that became, that came before it, you know, we said as much on the recording, but we were, Ben and I are avid Paul Thomas Anderson fans. And I recall seeing the film before its, you know, wide release in Chicago. I forgot the theater that I saw it at, some beautiful theater. It was rumored that Paul Thomas Anderson was actually there, like overseeing the projection.
Oh, wow.
Which I think, you know, from my memory, I don't know why I would remember that if it wasn't true. Just added an air of electricity to the whole experience. And I remember actually when I saw it, the movie ended with a different shot than the actual release. Mm. When I left that theater, I saw it with a bunch of friends. I remember I really couldn't speak for a couple hours. Wow. That movie really kind of floored me. And I likely texted or called Ben immediately, just telling him holy fuck, this movie, like, you know. And then it wasn't until I got back to Los Angeles and the movie started, you know, its tour, that we ended up seeing it at the ArcLight. Ben, did we see it at the Dome? I don't remember. Like, we saw
it. We did see it at the
production,
Dome,
right?
Yeah. I can even remember roughly where we were sitting. We were like down on the floor on the sort of like right-hand side of the middle section.
Do you remember what food or candy you were eating at the time?
I don't know if I would have. I think I had a coffee, and okay. I do distinctly remember seeing Nash and Joel Edgerton in front of us in line buying tickets, I believe to also see the movie or something. Because I remember we were in line, and I was like, "This is a guy with this like huge beard in front of us." And then I realized it was Joel Edgerton, and it was, I think he had just been filming Zero Dark 30, because he had that beard, because he played one of the Navy SEALs. Was that, I think,
right,
that true?
Yeah.
Okay. But at the time, being like, what the fuck is an actor like that doing with a huge beard? What a weird choice. And then seeing that, I was like, oh, that's what that was. That's a weird, distinct memory I have.
Yeah, yeah.
That day. But yeah, it was like a Saturday.
I do, also remember that we were like the only two people like distinctly laughing throughout that entire movie at moments. That's one thing that kind of, you know, came to pass for us, is recognizing, at least for me personally, like, you know, the first time I saw the movie, it floored me emotionally. The second time, and then, you know, the following many times, the movie just became funnier and funnier, notwithstanding, you know, maintaining its emotional grip throughout. But it's a deeply funny movie.
I mean, Joaquin Phoenix is so, I mean, it's so subtle, but like that sequence, you know, where they go to that party and he's trying to steal stuff and fit things in his jacket, and just the way that he walks around the room, it's funny. You know, for you guys, for each of you, when you watch PTA movies or you see this particular film, is there something from a writing and a directing perspective where you say, man, I wish I was better at X the way that he is?
That's a good question. I mean, I wish I could find ideas the way he does. Now, I say that knowing that, as far as I can tell, I mean, you know, it seems like he has one idea every 5 years and then he just makes it. You know what I mean? Like, it's like Paul's not the kind of guy that you hear interviews with where he's just rambling off about 15 unfinished or right. unmade movies. You know, it seems like, so I say I wish I could have that, but that may also, part of his ability to find interesting ideas may come at the cost of time. So maybe I don't actually want that, but I'm consistently so impressed to be like, this was the thing that he just decided to pour all of himself into, you know, like the oil industry and There'll Be Blood. Like, I just would never have thought of that. I don't think I would see what he sees in it.
Most of these things are not pitchable. I mean, they're
no, not at all.
No, you, yeah. It's all execution. It's like, here's my 160 page script and now I'm ready to go.
Yeah. And it's the confidence that he has, but that he's also, I mean, he's had reinforced over the course of his career, which is a really interesting career to look at. And I'm constantly, you know, using it as a reference point when thinking about directors and, you know, filmmakers. You know, these days, I don't think that Paul, it's not a normal career path, you know? Wow. And so, like, yeah, however it is that you get to that point of being able to come up with these ideas and then actually walk in with the confidence and the, you know, permission, I suppose, to make these kind of movies is, that's terribly inspiring. I don't know, Kevin, do you have a better answer?
I mean, I was thinking about it. You know, I'm just so often in awe of, you know, everything that, you know, makes up one of his films and like everything that he brings to a film. Ben's notion of like, you know, kind of navigating ideas and conjuring ideas and the amount of ideas that this guy seems to have at a given moment and any moment in his film, you know, it's so admirable. I just think, you know, his craftsmanship was one of the first things that really appealed to me, you know, being a you know, very visual person when I was young and like watching movies like Boogie Nights and Magnolia and hearing his commentary on Boogie Nights and stuff and hearing his love for cinema and recognizing like a kinship there, you know, or what I hoped at least. I think I came into his movies appreciating the craftsmanship of the films. And then as I grew and began to understand what cinema actually is and all the components that make it up, I started to see his movies as so much more, as this kind of integration of so many different things: performance, writing. Obviously, he's an unbelievable writer, and craftsmanship and visual and sound. I mean, all of the things together in this one kind of holistic, integrated thing. That's what makes his films so remarkable. They're the assemblage of all their parts. And that's just one thing I'm always looking to in anything that I do, is trying to account for every given aspect of what makes movies or what gives movies the potential to be truly, you know, great.
Okay, well, I'll give one more short answer that I bet Kevin will agree with okay. me on. So yes to both the things we just said, but then I bet we'll both agree. So one thing I'm jealous of, his relationship with actors. Like, yes. I know that that's something that comes naturally. And so I'm not saying, like, you know, you can't press a button and suddenly have 15 famous actor friends. But like, when you watch his movies and how once he gets somebody, he just keeps them, you know? And it's like when that somebody is like a Philip Seymour Hoffman, for instance, you're like, God damn, he has like three lines in P.T.'s first movie. And then to go from that all the way to The Master and go like, man, like, to know, like, I can only imagine how great that must feel to know that you have somebody of that caliber that is just like ready and willing to hear what you have to say. And so if you're like, hey, I got this idea, you're going to play this cult leader, it's like that's an idea that you could have, and it instantly becomes viable because you know that you have a relationship with an actor who will, you know, validate or at least entertain what you're going for. And if they're on board, you get to make a movie. That's honestly the thing that, like, I look at more as we're like, you know, you see it with a lot of directors, obviously, like people who have the actors they trust, that trust them. That's the thing that I think is the secret to a lot of filmmaking that people don't appreciate enough. And I think Paul's a really good example of somebody who uses that really responsibly and interestingly, you know.
Is for you, Kevin, is Charlie, is it Tejan? I don't want to bastardize his last name.
Oh, I think he'll take whatever you throw at him. But
you've worked.
I call him. I say Tahan.
Tahan. So Charlie is in Super Dark Times. He's also in Ozark, which you didn't direct. He shows up again in the episode you did on Hulu on Monsterland. Is he going to keep popping up in your films?
Yeah, I mean, Charlie is, you know, one of those like kind of incandescent rare talents that, you know, we were lucky with honestly everybody that we worked with on Super Dark Times. And I would be thrilled to work with any of them any given day. Charlie was also in the Lumineers 3 project
that I directed, following
Super Dark Times. And honestly, it's just these roles, these opportunities kind of just appeared. And it was hard for me not to think of Charlie because the working relationship on Super Dark Times was so formidable. And when you meet somebody like Charlie, when you meet somebody like Owen or Elizabeth or Max or Sawyer, you know, it's or Amy for crying out loud.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, she's,
you know,
amazing.
You're just thinking in your mind, how do I work with this person as much as possible? So I would be very grateful for more opportunities to work with any of them. Absolutely with Charlie as well.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing how all of the younger actors from Super Dark Times, like I'm always so happy for them when I hear they've booked another role or they got something exciting going on. But I'm very interested to see how they all progress in their careers and age, and I'm excited to work with any of them again for sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, the commentary is, this is my third beat of complimenting you guys. The commentary is a great listen. I appreciate you guys taking the time to do both of these things, the interview and the commentary. I want to call out stuff that's coming or stuff that is available now. So Kevin, as I mentioned, the second episode of Hulu's series that launched, I think, in October, Monsterland, the episode Eugene, mm-hmm. Oregon, that's out now on Hulu. You are in the midst of deciding if you're going to a faraway land to shoot a $100 million commercial. We'll wait to see what happens there. You're working on the next film with Ben and Luke. And Ben, for you guys, what's the deal? What's next? I mean, so we've got Night House through Fox Searchlight. Is there a release date on that?
Well, it probably would have been in theaters right now if it wasn't for the pandemic. I mean, it was one of those funny things that, like, we literally got back from Sundance and we had like a meeting over there just to, like, you know, because we didn't really know Searchlight before they bought the movie, and it was like an excited, like, all right, we can't wait to release this movie this year. And then and then I left the country, and then the pandemic
hit. You got trapped in Argentina, like, didn't you?
Yeah. I was, my girlfriend is living in Buenos Aires right now, and I went to see her. You know, it was going to be a little quick 2-week vacation that ended up being a 3-month long one that, made the first part of the quarantine much more entertaining. But it was, you know, so I watched from afar as the sort of industry kind of ground to a halt, mm-hmm. and everyone, you know, tried to figure these things out. So, I mean, for the first part of it, we were finishing some additional post-production on the Night House that Searchlight was enthusiastic in helping us do. And it's all done now. So it's really a question of, I guess, you know, their financial sort of business decisions about what the best way to, you know, if they hold and wait for a theatrical release or if they find some other solution. We don't really know, and I'm not really sure what they're saying about it. But personally, I'm fine in a way for it to wait because I'm very confident in the movie. It's, you know, Super Dark Times is... After we finished that movie, I was like, well, if nothing else, if the rest of my career is, you know, garbage, at least we made one good movie and I can be happy about that. Yeah. Night House is another one. And
so you've got
like,
two.
Now I have two good movies. So in that sense, I would be thrilled for it to be, you know, some people's first theatrical, you know, return after a vaccine or whatever we're looking at for the future. But at the same time, you know, I'm happy if there's another way that people can see it sooner. I want people to see it because I think they'll like it.
I can't wait to see it. I love Rebecca Hall. I worked with her on Christine.
Oh my God.
She's amazing. Yep. She's amazing. She deserves more than
she's the best.
Yeah,
Christine, by the way, I don't know if I've ever told you this. I saw Christine in the theater. And I believe that was right. I think it came out before we filmed Super Dark Times or maybe after what year did that come out, Paul?
I want to say 15.
Yeah, I think it was right before we filmed the movie, And I remember thinking, like, well, damn, like, this is a movie that took some risks that feel familiar to you to me. Is like, if mm-hmm. they could do it, yeah. you know, like, we certainly can. And then I remember when we first heard The Orchard brought up as like, oh, they want to release the movie. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, you know, I've still got the Christine lobby card up on my bulletin board to this day, actually. So I was like, yeah, well, they put that movie out. like, sounds like they know what they're doing. You know, yeah. I trust them on that one. So. Yeah. That movie rules. And then, yeah, getting to work with Rebecca was an absolute thrill. She's one of the most, maybe the most talented performer yeah. I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. And then what about Hellraiser with Bruckner?
That is something that it's we're hoping happens soon. I don't know how much I'm allowed to say, but yeah. that's something we've been working on throughout this year during the lockdown and everything. And we're working really hard, and fingers crossed, everyone's going to hear distinct updates about that in the news sooner than later. But it's been a really amazing opportunity, like life opportunity. Yeah. Writing a Hellraiser movie is something Luke and I've been wanting to do for many, 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 many years, and didn't think it was ever going to happen. And then kind of fate turned our way, and it did. So, you know, hopefully. You know, at the very least, getting to work on one this long has been a thrill in and of itself. But I really do hope the movie gets made, because we're really happy with the way it's going so far.
Well, fingers crossed. That's exciting. Well, okay. Yeah. Kevin Phillips, Ben Collins, thank you guys so much for the time. And we'll ask people to make sure after they finish this episode to queue up The Master, which is available on Netflix. It's available for rental or purchase on all your favorite digital platforms. And sit back, cook up some steak, and spend some more time with these two guys. Thank you guys for the time.
Thanks so much. Thanks, man. Thanks for having us.
Of course. And so there you have it. Director Kevin Phillips and screenwriter Ben Collins. Lots of great stuff coming for these guys. Don't forget, Monsterland is on Hulu now. The second episode, Eugene, Oregon, was directed by Kevin Phillips and stars Charlie Theron, who also is in Super Dark Times. As for Super Dark Times, it's on Netflix. It's on all of your favorite digital platforms. So if you haven't seen it, and you're a fan of that nostalgic thriller horror genre with kids and scrambled porn and all of the other things these guys talked about, it's well worth watching. It's really a great film. We'll look forward to Ben and Luke's new movie, The Night House, coming from Fox Searchlight. We're assuming in 2021, starring Rebecca Hall, and Hellraiser, with Ben and Luke writing the script, and David Bruckner, the director of The Night House, directing as well on that. As always, the 3 R's of podcasting: rate, review, and retweet. We appreciate your continued patronage. I want to thank all the folks at Consequence of Sound for bringing us into the fold of their podcasting empire. And as always, this is Paul Davidson saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you here next week on the Sidetrack.